This podcast is sponsored by Talkspace.
Last year, I went through many different life changes. I needed to take a pause and examine how I was feeling in the inside to better show up for the ones who need me to be my best version of myself.
When you're navigating life's changes, Talkspace can help. Talkspace is the number one rated online therapy, bringing you professional support from licensed therapists and psychiatry providers that you can access anytime, anywhere.
Living a busy life, navigating a long-distance relationship, becoming a first-step father, Talkspace made all of those journeys possible. I could speak with my therapist in the office. I could speak with my therapist in the comfort of my home. I was never alone.
Talkspace works with most major insurers, and most insured members have a $0 copay. No insurance, no problem. Now get $80 off your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com. Save $80 with code SPACE80 at Talkspace.com.
Welcome back to The Deep Dive, where we take the vast, complex world of information and distill it down to the knowledge you actually need.
Today, we're embarking on what you might call a mission-critical deep dive.
We're looking at the land service branch of the United States Armed Forces, the U.S. Army.
And it's really fitting that we start with the Army, because they hold this this unique distinction that speaks to their fundamental role in American history.
What's that?
They are officially the most senior branch in the order of precedence among the armed services. They predate the Constitution itself.
So this is the foundational force.
It is. And its complexity really reflects nearly 250 years of continuous and sometimes, you know, strategically discontinuous history.
That seniority, it immediately defines the scope of this deep dive, doesn't it? This is the primary ground-based offensive and defensive power of the United States.
Absolutely.
And for you, the learner, understanding the structure here is, I think, really key. It's essential to remember that while the Army operates under the overall authority of the Secretary of Defense, administratively, it falls under the specific purview of the Department of the Army,
which is one of the three specialized military departments inside the broader Department of Defense.
And when we talk about the scale of this organization, I mean, it's just gargantuan.
It really is. What's fascinating here is just the sheer volume of personnel required to maintain global land dominance. Based on the latest data from June 2025, the total uniform personnel size stands at approximately 946,961 soldiers.
Almost a million uniformed personnel. And that figure, it demands a closer look because it really represents the total force policy, which I know we'll get into later.
We will.
It's not just one giant active duty machine, is it?
Oh, far from it. That number is very carefully segmented and it reflects that integrated total force structure. You have the regular Army, which is the active component.
The full-time soldiers.
All right. They account for about 452,823 of that total. Then you have the absolutely critical reserve components. They provide specialized functions that the active Army just, well, it relies on them.
And those are the National Guard and the Army Reserve?
Exactly. You've got 328,084 personnel in the Army National Guard and another 170,601 in the Army Reserve.
And we often, I think, overlook the civilian backbone that supports this whole massive operation.
We do. And the stability and the expertise are so often supplied by that supporting structure. The Army also includes an additional 223,382 civilian personnel.
Wow.
And this massive civilian workforce, they manage everything from research and development to base operations, financial systems. They provide that essential long-term stability and institutional knowledge that soldiers, you know, who are rotating through active service just can't.
So if the structure is that massive and the components are so diverse, what is the core mission? What's the one goal that ties all of those active, reserve, and civilian personnel together?
The primary enduring mission statement is it's really an operational mandate.
Okay.
It's to fight and win our nation's wars by providing prompt, sustained land dominance across the full range of military operations.
Sustained land dominance. That phrase seems really important.
It's the key. It's not just about winning a single battle. It's about being able to occupy, secure, and then stabilize territory over time and distance.
And that's the journey we're taking today. We're going to connect the threads between those 18th century origins, when they were literally battling for land independence against a global power,
right,
to today's highly specialized, digitally integrated structure. And we'll touch on everything from their latest equipment to some really radical changes in how they manage human talent.
Okay, let's unpack this foundational identity. If you ask someone their birthday, they usually give you one date. But the U.S. Army, it actually has two foundational dates that define its existence.
And that reflects a very early national tension.
A tension that's rooted in the American political psyche.
Yeah, right.
Exactly. So the Army's traditional sort of celebratory birthday is June 14th, 1775. This is when the Second Continental Congress created the Continental Army for one specific reason.
To fight Great Britain.
To fight Great Britain. And of course, they appointed George Washington as the commander. That date marks the beginning of the land force organized under a central authority.
And when you look at that early Continental force, you see this kind of blending of influences that created a unique fighting style.
Well, they naturally drew heavily from British military heritage. I mean, their discipline, their linear tactics.
Because so many officers had served in colonial militias or even the British Army itself.
Absolutely. But, and this is the key thing, they were amateurs fighting a professional army. The maturation of that force was heavily reliant on external aid.
Primarily the French.
Primarily the French, who provided military doctrine, engineers, resources. And we absolutely cannot overlook individuals like the Prussian Baron Friedrich Wilhelm von Steuben.
He was critical at Valley Forge, wasn't he?
Oh, instrumental. He arrived at Valley Forge and essentially taught them Prussian Army tactics and organizational skills. He drafted the regulations for the order and discipline of the troops of the United States, which was, for all intents and purposes, the first standard manual of arms for the whole force.
He instilled professionalism where there had been, well, chaos.
Total chaos. So they win the war, they achieve independence, and then what happens? The Continental Army is quickly dissolved.
That's the core tension, isn't it? A deep distrust of centralized power.
That's the key. The Continental Army was quickly demobilized, reflecting that deep Republican distrust of standing armies. The founders were terrified that an army could be used by a tyrannical government against its own citizens.
So the nation was left with, what, just state militias?
Pretty much. State militias and a tiny federal force. Just one regiment to guard the western frontier and a single artillery battery to protect the West Point arsenal. That was it.
But history shows that vacuum didn't last long because distrust of standing armies very quickly collides with, we need immediate trained protection.
Precisely. Conflicts continued, particularly on the frontier against Native American tribes. And after several really bad military setbacks, like St. Clair's defeat in 1791, where over 800 soldiers were killed.
The disaster.
A total disaster. The need for a professional, trained, standing army became undeniable. So the United States Army was officially created on June 3, 1784, to replace the disbanded Continental Army.
Shifting to the present day, the Army's purpose isn't just historic tradition, it's actually codified in law.
Right, specifically in Title 10 U.S. Code, which lays out their statutory purpose in four distinct parts.
And that legal foundation, it's the bedrock of their modern operations. It really reveals the scope of their responsibility.
It does. The four defined purposes are, first, preserving the peace and security and providing for the defense of the United States, its commonwealth, possessions, and any occupied areas.
So that's the core defensive mandate.
That's the core defensive mandate. Second, supporting national policies. And third, implementing national objectives.
If we connect those two, they seem to encompass everything from disaster relief to really complex geopolitical maneuvers.
They do. And they provide the framework for when the Army is deployed outside of direct self-defense, engaging in, you know, diplomatic or stabilizing roles.
And the fourth purpose?
The fourth is perhaps the broadest. Overcoming any nations responsible for aggressive acts that imperil the peace and security of the United States.
That definition could cover everything from conventional wars to global counterterrorism operations.
Exactly.
So if that's the legal purpose, what are the five core competencies, the functional tasks they perform every day that define the complexity of their modern role?
This is the what they do list, and it shows how they achieve that land dominance we talked about. First, and most fundamentally, is providing prompt and sustained land combat. That's their reason for being.
Okay.
Second, they specialize in combined arms operations. This means the skillful integration of different capabilities, mechanized, armored, airborne, air assault operations, all working together to defeat an enemy.
And the third competency brings us into the realm of the highly specialized forces we will cover later on.
Right, special operations forces.
So the final two competencies, they seem to deal less with direct combat and more with enabling the entire joint military effort.
They do. The fourth is this massive logistical and infrastructure task of setting and sustaining the theater for the joint force.
What does that actually mean in practice?
It means establishing ports, airfields, supply lines, communications, for every other branch that follows them in. They get there first and build the foundation.
And the fifth competency?
Fifth is integrating national, multinational, and joint powers specifically on land. They are the essential anchor for any large-scale ground deployment, making sure that allied forces and sister services can all operate effectively in the most complex terrain.
Moving forward in time, the Army's evolution can, I think, only really be understood by looking at the defining conflicts that forged it. And here's a twist I didn't expect. The conflict that secured decades of diplomatic peace was actually considered, well, inconclusive in its immediate military gains.
You're talking about the War of 1812.
Exactly.
It ended with the Treaty of Ghent. And in pure military terms, you're right, it was a draw. Inconclusive. But if we connect this to the bigger picture, the long-term consequence was just immense, and it's often overlooked.
Which was?
It established a lasting period of peace between the U.S. and Great Britain that has persisted for over two centuries. A military conflict that secured enduring diplomatic stability.
And you have the Seminole Wars, which spanned over 50 years. That forced the Army to confront a really early form of unconventional warfare, something very different from the European model.
It did. The difficulty posed by the Seminoles stemmed directly from the geography of Florida and, you know, the ingenuity of the tribe.
How so?
Historically, the U.S. military used clear strategies against tribes. You seize their winter food supplies to force surrender, or you form alliances with their neighbors.
Standard playbook.
Right. But neither strategy was viable against the Seminoles. Florida didn't have the climate variability to produce a reliable winter food cache to seize. And there was already this long history of tribal warfare in the region, which meant reliable alliances for the U.S. were just hard to form.
So it forced them to adapt.
It forced the Army to adapt to a brutal, swampy counterinsurgency environment very early on, relying on small, mobile forces rather than large conventional formations.
Okay, fast forward slightly to the Mexican-American War. That was a clear, if, you know, controversial U.S. victory that physically redefined the nation's borders.
Absolutely. The victory resulted in the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo, which transferred just a massive amount of land to the United States.
We're talking about the land that makes up modern-day California, Nevada, New Mexico.
Arizona, Texas, and parts of Colorado and Wyoming. That Army victory was pivotal. It instantly secured nearly a third of the continental U.S. and really defined its manifest destiny.
But the deadliest test, the conflict that showed the potential scale of American manpower and industrial mobilization, was, of course, the American Civil War.
It remains the costliest war in U.S. history by far. The sheer human toll is just hard to comprehend. We're talking 620,000 deaths on both sides.
And to put that demographic impact into stark relief.
8% of all white males aged 13 to 43 died in that war. The South, with a smaller overall population, saw even higher devastation.
And the Union strategy employed by leaders like Grant and Sherman was so crucial because it moved beyond just winning field battles to total economic warfare. The Anaconda Plan.
The Union strategy was fundamentally about strangulation. It focused on seizing the coastline, blockading ports to cut off Confederate trade, and crucially, it controlled the major river systems.
Like the Vicksburg Campaign.
The Vicksburg Campaign, under General Grant, seized the Mississippi River, and that effectively split the Confederacy in two and completely strangled their economic and logistical capacity. It showed that sustained land dominance required control of strategic lines of communication, whether they were roads, rail, or rivers.
The industrial mobilization of the Civil War showed the potential scale of American manpower, a lesson that seems to have been tragically forgotten until the eve of World War II.
Which brings us to a shocking fact about the Army's size in 1939.
It's genuinely hard to believe, isn't it?
It really is, given what the Army became just a few years later. In 1939, right as the world was about to explode into global conflict, estimates placed the U.S. Army's strength between 174,000 and 200,000 soldiers.
Which ranked it where globally?
Only 17th or 19th. It was smaller than the Army of Portugal. Smaller than the size of the New York City Police Department today.
That shocking deficit just underscores the monumental task faced by leaders like General George C. Marshall.
Marshall became Army Chief of Staff in September 1939, and he immediately led the effort to expand and modernize the Army. He instituted the largest mobilization of forces and equipment in human history.
And that preparation paid off massively.
It did. Some 11 million Americans served in various Army operations during World War II, transitioning the U.S. from, you know, an isolationist power to a global superpower almost overnight.
And then once the war was over, we saw that familiar American impulse to rapidly demobilize.
Yes. The demobilization was extremely sharp. They dropped from 8 million soldiers in 1945 down to 684,000 by 1947.
And that was seen as a success.
By most accounts, yes, a successful, if traumatic, transition. And this post-war period also saw two critical structural changes that define the modern military.
First, the separation of the Army Air Forces in 1947.
Which became the independent U.S. Air Force. And second, the desegregation of the armed forces via President Truman's Executive Order 99981 in 1948.
So the end of World War II immediately plunges the Army into the Cold War context. What was the central strategic challenge for them during those first few decades?
After Korea, the Army's strategic focus during the Cold War was really defined by the doctrine of containment, and it was anchored largely in Europe.
Right.
We were essential to NATO's forward defense strategy. We maintained massive forces armored divisions, mechanized infantry, deployed in West Germany to deter a potential Soviet tank invasion.
Which required a huge standing force.
A huge force, constantly trained and equipped for conventional high-intensity tank warfare on the plains of Central Europe.
But that conventional readiness, which paid dividends decades later in the Gulf War, seemed to be entirely the wrong tool for the conflict that immediately followed Vietnam.
It was.
What specifically made Vietnam such a structural and doctrinal low point for the Army?
Well, the system was designed to fight the Soviets, not revolutionaries in a jungle. The reliance on conscription, on draftees, meant high turnover and very low institutional experience.
And the strategy itself was flawed.
The attrition strategy they employed was strategically unsustainable and politically unpopular. It led to a force that struggled immensely against the highly committed, unconventional tactics of the Viet Cong and the North Vietnamese Army. It exposed a fundamental weakness in our ability to conduct counterinsurgency operations.
And that failure led directly to one of the most critical policy shifts still impacting the Army today.
The total force policy.
This is a vital connection point for the modern Army, and it's a direct response to the political fallout of Vietnam.
It is. General Creighton Abrams adopted the total force policy post-Vietnam, which officially treated the regular Army, the active component, the Army National Guard, and the Army Reserve as a single integrated force.
Okay, let's unpack that. It sounds like a logistical decision treating them all as one force, but what was the critical political implication of that move?
That's the key. The strategic genius of the policy. By intentionally assigning nearly all essential combat support roles, like logistics, medical units, heavy transportation, signal corps to the Guard and Reserve components, Abrams made it politically impossible.
Impossible for any future administration to launch a prolonged, large-scale, and potentially unpopular war without first doing what?
Without first calling up the citizen soldier. It tethered public support and congressional buy-in directly to the willingness to deploy the National Guard. You just cannot deploy heavy active divisions overseas for long without those reserve units following them.
That integrated force was then showcased in the 1990s and the 21st century. The Gulf War was a massive, decisive military reversal of the previous few decades.
Operation Desert Storm in 1991 was a resounding victory. It utilized a U.S.-led coalition that deployed over 500,000 troops, the bulk of which were U.S. Army formations.
And it was historically significant for the scale of the fighting.
It featured the largest, most effective tank battles in history. Battles like Medina Ridge, Norfolk, and 73 Easting. It proved the Army's doctrine of deep attack and swift mechanized maneuver warfare that they had developed during the Cold War.
But the Army's next major commitment, post 9/11, demanded a rapid and difficult pivot away from that conventional doctrine.
It did. The attacks of September 11th hit the Army hard. 53 Army civilians and 22 soldiers were killed in the Pentagon attack alone.
And the subsequent decades saw the Army lead ground forces in Afghanistan and Iraq.
Right. And what's fascinating here is the rapid operational shift. Within months, they pivoted from the conventional set-piece battles they had just perfected in Desert Storm to prolonged, complex counterinsurgency, or COIN, operations.
Which required a fundamental change in mindset.
A total change. It focused on population security, stability, and defeating decentralized guerrilla tactics rather than state-on-state warfare.
That rapid operational shift brings us right into the structure of the modern Army. It is a highly effective, complex organization governed by this dual system of civilian and military control.
Yes, and let's start with the dual leadership at the very top.
The structure is intentional design to embed civilian control, a principle that dates all the way back to that early American distrust of standing armies.
It is. So you have the Secretary of the Army, or SecArmy. This is the civilian senior appointed civil servant holding statutory authority over all Army affairs, personnel, budget, infrastructure, but ultimately operating under the authority of the Secretary of Defense.
And then on the military side, you have the four-star general who serves as the chief of staff of the Army, the CSA.
The CSA is the highest-ranked military officer in the Army. He serves as the principal military advisor and executive agent for the Sec Army, supervising the Army staff. And critically, the CSA also serves on the Joint Chiefs of Staff,
which is the body that advises the President and Secretary of Defense on operational matters.
Right.
Now, this raises a really crucial point of confusion for many. If the CSA is the top general, does he command the troops in, say, Iraq or Germany?
No, absolutely not. And this is where the Goldwater-Nichols Act of 1986 comes into play.
A truly critical piece of legislation.
It was passed in response to poor operational coordination during events like the Grenada invasion. It mandated a very clear separation of authority and mission.
What does that mean?
It means the service secretaries and service chiefs, like the Sec Army and the CSA, only have the responsibility to organize, train, and equip their forces. That's it.
So the Army prepares the forces, but they don't deploy or command them in wartime.
Precisely. The operational chain of command flows directly from the President through the Secretary of Defense to the unified combatant commanders who run the regional theaters, like CINTCOM or INDOPACOM. The Army provides the trained and equipped forces to those commanders.
So operational control is clearly separated from service administration.
Very clearly.
Let's look again at the three primary components that constitute that total force, legally speaking, which we touched on earlier.
Okay, so first you have the regular Army. That's the full-time active component, ready to deploy at a moment's notice anywhere in the world. They're governed exclusively by Title 10 of the U.S. Code.
Which defines federal military roles.
Correct. Then there is the Army Reserve, also primarily under Title 10. These are part-time soldiers who train monthly and conduct annual training. They often specialize in high-demand support capabilities.
And the component that tends to get the most complex legally and politically is, of course, the National Guard.
The Army National Guard has a unique dual status. When they are not federalized, they operate under the authority of their state or territorial governor, and they're governed by Title 32.
So they're the troops called upon for domestic emergencies, like hurricane relief or civil unrest.
Exactly. But they're also simultaneously reserve members of the U.S. Army under the President's authority. And here is a key point in U.S. law. The National Guard can be federalized by presidential order, even against the express wishes of the state governor.
Which moves them from Title 32 to Title 10 status.
Right. They become a federal asset.
So if we move down to the operational unit level, the Army went through a massive overhaul in the 2000s, shifting away from divisions as the static base fighting unit to what we now call modular brigades.
This was a necessity, really, driven by the demands of operations in Afghanistan and Iraq, where you needed highly specialized, flexible deployments.
So how did it work before?
Historically, a division was a fixed structure. It only commanded brigades that carried its specific lineage. The transformation to modularity means division headquarters, well, they retain their lineage, but they're now designed to command any brigade package, regardless of its original divisional identity.
And these operational packages are standardized into three major types of brigade combat teams, or BCTs.
Right, and they're structured by their mobility and firepower.
What are the three types?
You have the armor brigades, which are the heaviest. They're built around the M1 Abrams tank and the M2 Bradley with about 4,743 troops. They're optimized for high-intensity conflict.
Okay.
Next are the striker brigades, built around the eight-wheeled striker vehicle. They have about 4,500 troops, and they're meant to balance mobility and protection.
And the third type?
The infantry brigades. These are the lightest, mostly foot mobile, but still highly lethal, with around 4,413 troops.
And this modularity allows combatant commanders to tailor the force package precisely to the mission requirements.
Exactly. They can deploy the right level of protection and mobility, whether it's desert warfare or mountain operations.
This constant evolution and restructuring is managed by a specific body focused on the future, right?
That is the Army Futures Command, or AFC. It's a four-star command established in 2018.
And its mission is explicit.
Modernization reform. Designing future hardware, and working to speed up the notoriously slow acquisition process. They're the innovation engine, ensuring the Army doesn't spend decades acquiring equipment that is already obsolete before it even reaches the field.
And that focus on the future, it requires serious financial backing, of course.
It demands a total reprioritization. The FY2020 budget really underscored this. It allocated $30 billion specifically for the top six modernization goals over 5 years.
And this wasn't just new money.
No, that's the key. It was generated by $8 billion in cost avoidance and $22 billion realized through program terminations. They were serious about cutting existing, redundant, or failing programs to fund the future.
Let's look now at the sharp edge of the spear, Special Operations Forces, or USSO. This organization is intensely specialized and represents the absolute peak of the total force.
Starting with the 1st Special Forces Command, commonly known as the Green Berets, they execute 9 doctrinal missions.
And these missions, they span the complex spectrum of modern conflict.
They do. They focus on long-term, politically sensitive tasks like unconventional warfare, foreign internal defense, which is training allied militaries, direct action, counterinsurgency, and counterterrorism. Their ability to operate autonomously and blend in is crucial.
And within USSA, we find the most elite ground units, like the 75th Ranger Regiment and Delta Force. What's the operational difference between the two?
So the 75th Ranger Regiment is elite airborne infantry. They specialize in large-scale joint forcible entry operations and precision targeting raids.
So think of them as the unit that can seize an airfield or execute a rapid, complex raid on a target location.
Exactly. They bridge the gap between traditional combat units and deep special operations.
And then there's the unit commonly known as Delta Force, or the UNIT.
That is the 1st Special Forces Operational Detachment Delta, SFODD. It's the Army's Tier 1 Special Mission Unit.
And they are tasked with the most complex, classified, and dangerous missions directed by the National Command Authority.
Right, specializing in things like hostage rescue and high-stakes counterterrorism. The source material highlights the extreme breadth of their potential tasks. It notes their 8 specialized squadrons include not only assault and aviation squadrons, but also a clandestine squadron and a highly unique nuclear disposal squadron.
A nuclear disposal squadron, that tells you the level of threat mitigation they are expected to handle.
It certainly does.
If the Army is moving to modular units and futuristic equipment, the biggest revolution is actually happening in, of all places, the Human Resources Department.
That's absolutely right.
It's changing how soldiers are tracked, managed, and promoted. And this is a huge bureaucratic lift.
It is. The shift toward formal talent management is probably the most significant non-combat reform in decades. The old system was all about time and grade. The new system wants to match individual capabilities to specific job requirements across the entire force.
And central to this is something called the Integrated Personnel and Pay System Army, or IPPSA.
Right.
Let's define that acronym immediately. What is IPPSA and why is it so revolutionary for the Army?
IPPSA is a new centralized cloud-based human resources system. And it is revolutionary because, for the very first time, it unites personnel data for all 3 components, active, National Guard, and reserve, into one searchable database.
And it's even available as a mobile app.
As a mobile app. This breaks down the fragmentation that used to plague the total force. It allows the Army to find the right soldier with the right skills for the right job, regardless of what component they're in.
And IPPSA supports crucial leadership initiatives like the Battalion Commander Assessment Program, or BCAP. How did BCAP fundamentally change how commanders are selected?
BCAP moved beyond just ranking candidates based on time and grade or past performance reviews. Instead, they used this grueling 5-day holistic assessment program at Fort Knox.
And they evaluate candidates using 25 distinct criteria.
They do. This includes a psychological evaluation, peer reviews, and, importantly, incorporating the officer's personal preference for assignments. This ensures the Army isn't just promoting the officer who stayed out of trouble, but the one who has the greatest potential for success in a command climate they actually want to be in.
That sounds like a much more holistic approach to leadership selection. And I understand there are also changes to what review boards can see when considering promotions.
Yes, a kind of transparency with a warning.
How so?
The focus is on a complete picture of performance. Promotion boards can now see almost all substantiated adverse information in an officer's human resource record that may have previously been hidden or, you know, buried.
So it forces officers to stay constantly familiar with their records.
It does. They have to file prompt rebuttals to any adverse information, and it ensures that the selection process is making decisions based on the most accurate, complete picture of a leader's track record.
Let's move to the personnel system itself, how the different ranks are structured, which is often a point of interest for civilian learners.
Okay, so we have 3 primary categories. First, officers from O1 to O10. They are the strategic and operational decision makers.
And the paths to commissioning include West Point, ROTC, officer candidate school,
and direct commissioning for specialists like doctors or lawyers.
And they operate under what's called the Defense Officer Personnel Management Act of 1980, or DOPMA.
Right, which essentially creates the up or out system.
Can you explain that?
DOPMA establishes the rules for promotion timing, and it sets limits on the total number of officers allowed in each rank. It mandates that officers who fail to be promoted after a certain number of attempts or years of service must typically retire or separate.
And as for how to address them?
Generals are always addressed as general name. Colonels and lieutenant colonels are both addressed simply as colonel name. It's an easy rule to remember.
Then you have the warrant officers, who are these specialty personnel, the single-track experts who are critical to highly technical roles.
Warrant officers, W1 to W5, are the deep subject matter experts. They're often pilots, intelligence analysts, or senior technical advisors.
And how are they addressed?
By regulation, they are addressed as Mr. Mince's name by senior officers. But it's very common for enlisted personnel to address them as chief name as a sign of respect for their expertise.
Finally, the bedrock of the force, the enlisted personnel from E1 to E9. And this is where we see that division between non-commissioned officers, or NCOs, and specialists.
Right. The NCO sergeants and corporals are the vital link between officers and the rank and file. They exercise direct leadership responsibilities,
which distinguishes them from specialists.
We share the same E4 pay grade, but are primarily focused on technical tasks without formal command duties.
And there was a significant change in 2021 regarding the rank of corporal, which is at that E4 level. It formalized the requirement for leadership education.
This change was intended to reinforce the corporal's role as a non-commissioned officer, not just a senior specialist. Since 2021, all corporals must complete the Basic Leader Course, or BLC.
A key NCO development school.
A key school. Or they must be laterally assigned as specialists. And what's interesting is that BLC qualified specialists can now be permitted to wear the corporal rank before their formal promotion.
Which signals to their peers and leaders that they are prepared and qualified to assume NCO responsibilities.
Precisely.
That focus on readiness extends to the training pipeline itself, which has seen several major extensions in recent years.
Initial training combines basic combat training, BCT, with advanced individualized training, or AIT. For some military occupational specialties, these are combined into one station unit training, or OSU.
And the Army is intentionally extending the duration of these pipeline courses. Why the expansion?
It's a direct result of lessons learned from years of quiet operations, where soldiers needed a higher baseline of combat skills immediately upon arrival.
So, for example, the infantry OSU pilot was extended to 22 WINTs.
Right. And the armor OSU is expanding to 22 weeks, with others for cavalry, engineer, and military police also expanding. This extended training just allows for more repetition and better honing of combat skills like marksmanship and fieldcraft. It's about bolstering lethality before they even reach their first unit.
Looking at recruiting, the Army has faced significant challenges since the COVID-19 pandemic. Their solution addresses those who don't quite meet the initial entry requirements.
It does. They introduced the Future Soldier Prep Course, or FSPC. This is designed to assist potential recruits who don't initially meet either the physical fitness or academic standards for immediate entry.
And the academic component is the most heavily utilized part of the program.
By far. It focuses on basic math, English, and other essential skills necessary for military training.
So what does the success of this FSPC program tell us about the changing nature of the potential recruit?
It suggests the Army is willing to invest in human capital that traditional systems might filter out. It tells us that the pool of eligible recruits is shrinking, forcing the Army to provide remedial training that wasn't previously necessary.
And it's not a niche program.
Far from it. In the fiscal year ending in September 2023, approximately 13,000 recruits, a striking 24%, participated in the FSPC. That indicates a heavy reliance on this course to maintain recruitment quotas.
Finally, the physical standard itself changed dramatically with the introduction of the Army Combat Fitness Test, the ACFT.
The ACFT supersedes the old Army Physical Fitness Test, the APFT. And the motivation was clear. The APFT tested muscle endurance sit-ups, push-ups, and running speed, but wasn't scientifically correlated to combat survival tasks.
So the new test, the ACFT, is designed to better predict combat survival by testing full-body functional fitness.
Exactly. And what's groundbreaking here is that the test and the scoring system are the same for all soldiers, regardless of gender.
What are the six key movements they determined were more relevant to battlefield actions?
Okay, so the test lasts about an hour and includes six events: First is the 3-repetition maximum deadlift. This simulates lifting heavy equipment or pulling a casualty.
Makes sense.
Second, a standing power throw of a 10-pound medicine ball, which simulates throwing equipment over a barrier. Third, hand-release push-ups for a more comprehensive measure of chest and core strength.
And the final 3.
Fourth is the sprint drag carry event, which mimics the explosive effort needed to sprint for cover, drag a fellow soldier, and carry ammunition cans. Fifth is 3 pull-ups with leg tucks, or a plank test as an alternative. And finally, the 2-mile run for aerobic endurance.
And this became the official test of record for the entire force on October 1st, 2020.
It did. A major shift.
Shifting our focus now to the hardware and the gear, the modernization priorities are what will define the future Army. The Chief of Staff has laid out 6 clear priorities, and they are listed in a specific order for a reason.
They are. That order of precedence reflects where the greatest capability gaps and needs are perceived, specifically in the context of preparing for a high-intensity conflict against a near-peer adversary.
It's a move away from the coyine focus of the last 2 decades.
A definite move.
So let's walk through the 6.
Okay, 1, artillery, or long-range precision fires. 2, ground vehicles, like the next-generation combat vehicle. 3, aircraft. 4, network. 5, air and missile defense. And 6, soldier lethality.
That list, especially with artillery at the top, signals a shift back toward preparing for large-scale, deep-strike conventional conflict.
It does. It shows that the ability to operate effectively within a contested network environment has become paramount.
If we look at the ground combat systems, the Army relies so heavily on mechanized warfare, fueling a massive ratio of vehicles to soldiers.
That ratio is a defining characteristic of the modern U.S. Army. Based on previous data, they field the highest vehicle-to-soldier ratio in the world. It's all about prioritizing protection, mobility, and firepower for land dominance.
And what are the workhorses of that mechanized warfare, the systems the Army knows best?
The main battle tank is the iconic M1A2 Abrams, which is constantly being upgraded with new digital systems and armor packages.
And the standard infantry fighting vehicle.
That's the M2A3 Bradley, designed to transport infantry while providing fire support. Then you have highly mobile platforms like the 8-wheeled Stryker and the ubiquitous Humvee.
The HMMWV, which is still serving in myriad roles.
Right, it is. From cargo carry to ambulance, though it is being phased out in frontline combat roles.
What about the indirect fire support, the artillery that tops that modernization list? What assets do they rely on?
Their principal artillery assets have to be highly mobile and capable of massive sustained firepower. So you have the M109A7 Paladin self-propelled howitzer.
Which offers protection and speed.
Right. But crucially, they rely on the M270 multiple launch rocket system, the MLRS, for deep strikes. And for lighter units, they use towed howitzers, like the 155mm M777 for infantry and airborne support.
Let's turn to the network, which is priority 4. Why is a system that sounds like IT infrastructure considered a top-tier modernization priority alongside tanks and aircraft?
Because that is the future of warfare. The network priority is about connecting every sensor, every shooter, and every command node across the entire battlefield.
So we're talking about massive projects like Project Convergence.
And achieving Joint All-Domain Command and Control, JADC2. If you can't securely communicate across vast distances and integrate air, land, sea, and cyber assets, you lose the information war before it even starts. This priority ensures data flows seamlessly from a satellite to a soldier's helmet display.
Let's discuss individual soldier weapons. The M4 carbine has been the standard for decades, but it's starting to be replaced in certain units. What's the operational necessity driving that?
It's being driven by the need to defeat modern body armor at longer ranges. The M4 carbine, firing the 5.56mm cartridge, is being gradually replaced by the M7 rifle in close combat units.
As part of the Next Generation SCOD Weapons Initiative.
Correct. The M7 fires a new, higher caliber 6.8mm round, designed for increased penetration and lethality against peer threats. And the standard sidearm is the M17 pistol from the Modular Handgun System program.
And for anti-armor capabilities, infantry units have a few key systems.
They do. You have the AT-4, which is an unguided, shoulder-launched projectile effective against armor up to 500 meters.
And for more sophisticated, guided anti-tank missiles.
They rely on the fire-and-forget FGM-148 Javelin and the heavier, vehicle-mounted BGM-71 TOW. And the FIM-92 Stinger is still in use. That's the shoulder-launched, heat-seeking anti-aircraft missile critical for short-range air defense.
Moving to the air, Army Aviation has a very specific focus, and it's largely limited by inter-service agreements.
Yes, the focus is almost entirely on rotary wing aircraft helicopters. This stems from the 1966 Johnson-McConnell Agreement,
which historically restricted the Army's fixed-wing aviation role primarily to administrative mission support.
Right, using light, unarmed aircraft and leaving combat jets and long-range transport to the Air Force.
So we're talking about the famous trio of attack and transport helicopters.
We are. The attack helicopter is the venerable AH-64 Apache, the core of their aerial firepower. For utility and transport, the UH-60 Blackhawk is the key system. And for heavy lift, especially moving artillery or massive loads, they use the tandem rotor CH-47 Chinook.
And for the future, they're heavily integrating unmanned systems.
They are, deploying at least one company of drone MQ-1C Grey Eagles to each active Army division to provide persistent surveillance and attack capability.
Finally, let's talk aesthetics and tradition. The uniform is changing with the highly anticipated introduction of the Army Greens.
The Army announced this new uniform in 2018. It's a purposeful nod to tradition, based on the iconic pinks and greens uniforms worn during World War II.
Which carry significant historical prestige.
They do. It's projected to become the standard garrison service uniform, eventually replacing the blue Army service uniform for daily office wear. The current field uniform remains the ACU with the Operational Camouflage Pattern, or OCP.
And what about the black beret, which was famously controversial a decade ago?
It was eliminated for standard use with the ACU for garrison duty back in 2011. It was replaced by the standard patrol cap, mainly due to complaints that it was hot, uncomfortable, and unsuited for most work conditions.
So now the beret is reserved exclusively for specialized units, linking back to their heritage.
Exactly. Maroon for jump status units, tan for the Ranger Regiment, rifle green for Special Forces, and brown for the Security Force Assistance Brigades, or SFEs.
So what does this all mean for you, the learner? This deep dive has covered centuries of military evolution and organizational restructuring in a really short time.
I think the key takeaway is the dynamic blend of history and hypermodernity. The Army maintains its 18th century continuous service tradition, yet it has undergone these radical 21st century changes.
Like the move to the flexible modular brigade structure.
And implementing sophisticated talent management systems like IPPSA and the BCAP assessment process, they are transforming from a mass mobilization force to an agile, talent-focused organization.
And for anyone trying to understand U.S. military power today, the most valuable structural insight is the reality of the total force policy and what it truly enables.
That cannot be overstated. General Abrams' post-Vietnam policy means that all components, active, guard, and reserve, are just tightly interwoven.
And the political genius of that is that the reserve components provide the majority of combat support and service support.
Meaning sustained operations simply are not possible without activating the guard and reserve. Understanding the Army means understanding that deployment reliance spans all three components, tying military action directly to the will of the state and the nation.
It's a structure that learns, adapts, and reacts to the shifting nature of warfare. We saw how they moved from the Cold War focus on conventional mechanized battles, like in the Gulf War,
to 2 decades of focused counterinsurgency, or COIN, operations after 9/11.
And this brings us to the final provocative thought. Army leadership noted a major pivot post-2017. Unit-level training has shifted back from COIN, which focused on stability and winning hearts and minds, back toward decisive action training,
which focuses on large-scale conventional conflicts against peer adversaries. However, there is an acknowledged gap.
What exactly is the challenge raised by Army leadership regarding the current state of training?
Well, General Milley noted that the force, having optimized its training and doctrine for the desert, rolling terrain and counterinsurgency of the Middle East and Central Asia for 20 years, is currently suboptimized.
Suboptimized for what?
For training in extreme environments, like cold weather regions, jungles, mountains, or densely packed urban areas. Urban warfare, for example, severely restricts the use of heavy mechanized assets and traditional long-range communications.
So while the Army is modernizing its equipment like artillery and the network and focusing on conventional deterrence, the true challenge remains ensuring soldiers are adaptable and ready for any geographical contingency.
Right. It raises a crucial question for the future.
Which is,
how quickly can a force optimized for the deserts and open plains, where command and control is relatively easy, adapt its training, its logistics, and its doctrine to operate and win in extreme three-dimensional densely contested urban environments or the resource-scarce high Arctic should global conflicts necessitate it.
That adaptability to unknown and extreme environments is the core challenge required for the coming decades.
It is.
A challenge only the world's most senior, yet constantly evolving, land force is equipped to face. Thank you for joining us for the Deep Dive.